And now our main topic today, our book doctors and the best books of 2014. Our book doctors today are Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. She's been a freelance writer and book reviewer for 30 years. Jeff, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Steve Paul is editor of the Star's editorial page, and he's a former book editor at the newspaper. Steven, welcome.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me back.
Katie Stover is the director of reader services for the Kansas City Public Library. Katie, good morning to you.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
Angela Cervantes is the author of Gabby, Lost and Found in 2014. Angela was named one of the top 10 new Latino authors to watch by LatinoStories.com. And Angela, welcome to you, too. Welcome
Thank
back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just dive right in here. We have so many good books to cover here. Jeff, let's go to Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, Can't We?
You know, I absolutely was mesmerized by this book and read it in one sitting, which is unusual for me.
In one sitting.
Yeah. Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant
like you.
By Roz Chast. Roz Chast, of course, is the longtime cartoonist for The New Yorker. And this is the story of her parents' end-of-life years. And she writes with incredible candor and does it with her signature art, in which most of the figures appear kind of high-waisted and kind of dorky and very, very angsty. Can't we talk about something more pleasant? Usually this is the kind of topic that we don't talk about it until it's right on top of it. And this is what happened with Roz Chast and her parents. Her parents grew up within two blocks of each other in East Harlem and then moved into the Brooklyn apartment that Roz Chast grew up in and where they stayed their entire lives until she virtually had to sandblast them out when they were both 93. Roz Chast's mother was an assistant elementary school principal who had a legendary temper. And she herself would say, "I'm going to blow my top. Look out for a blast from Chast." And Roz Chast's father was sort of the meek and mild, you know, member of the duo. And he was a very sensitive guy. And Roz Chast's mother would make fun of him and his feelers. You know, he had so many feelers. But anyway, She was the only child of older parents, and since I had a daughter at 32 but a son at 47, I really resonated and resonated also with some of the comments that were made on the playground. And I just want to read just one little panel here of kids talking about her parents.
So this is a whole book. Is it a visual book?
It's a graphic book? Memoir.
Graphic memoir.
Graphic memoir. That's
yeah.
right. I should have said that.
Yeah.
Two things about my childhood. One, I was an only child, and two, my parents were a lot older than other kids' parents. One kid said, "Your mom's old." Another kid, "She's like a zillion." Another kid, "Your dad's old, too." Another kid, "That means they're going to die soon." And then Roz Chast said, "And even when they really were a zillion, they and I never talked about the future." So anyway, this is, as I said, the story of their last years, and it's painful, it's candid. It kind of reminded me of David Small's Stitches in terms of the character having a very difficult relationship with a mother. But the mother here is much
also,
more humanity
also a graphic,
and humor.
Also a graphic memoir.
Yeah, also a graphic memoir. Yeah, exactly. But the mother here has much more humanity and much more humor. And Roz Chast had a difficult relationship with her till the very end. And on her deathbed, she said, "Mom, isn't it too bad that we weren't more like friends?" And her mom said, "No, I don't really think so." So unrelenting right to the end. So I couldn't really recommend it highly enough. I nominated it for the top 100 books of the year in the Kansas City Star, and it made it. And it was a top 10 book for the New York Times Book Review.
That book again is?
Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant?
I'm still hung up on the notion that you read it in one sitting, and not that I know
it's a graphic memoir.
That I know you cheated just a little bit and just trying to make yourself feel better in front of all of us.
No, one thing I would like to say just is I'm amazed that graphic memoirs through art can handle such dark, dark subjects.
That's
Art Spiegelman's Mouse and on, so on.
Okay, that's Jeff Ann Gowdy's first pick for one of her favorite books, best books of 2014. Katie Stover, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
A wonderful choice, considering we just finished talking about something about more pleasant, and Caitlin Doughty does want to talk about this subject.
Yes, she does.
Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which is her occupational memoir of what it's like to work in a crematorium. She visited the Kansas City Public Library in the beginning of November.
And gave
a lovely talk about her book and her life as probably one of the youngest morticians you've ever met. And I love this book because it never occurred to me that you could think about pondering mortality and be funny at the same time. And she was. It's very insightful. And she looks at the funeral industry with very frank eyes. She's honest about funeral practices. And her belief is that if Americans only had all the information available to them, then all their questions answered, no matter how outlandish or mundane, they'd have a better relationship with the Grim Reaper. They'd have a better handle on how to deal with the deaths of loved ones. Mm-hmm. Her bent is that we have a really warped sense of how to deal with death. There's so much emotion, there's so much grief, there's so much guilt, and Caitlin Doughty believes that a good deal of that comes from the way we are separated so much from the death process. We're separated because we don't want to talk about an unpleasant topic.
And it didn't used to be that way, she points out in the book.
Right, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Families used to take care of their own dead, and it was a lot easier to get past the grieving process. And now we don't. We have the funeral homes that keep a real distance between the grieving folks and their loved one. So I just happened to flip through this book one more time last night and found her scribblings when she was a young working in the crematorium, and she wanted to open her own mortuary and call it La Belle Morte Funeral Home, where they put the fun back in funeral. She wanted to take ashes and turn them into paintings, or, you know, crush them into tattoo ink, or maybe make pencils or hourglasses, or heck, you know, shoot your ashes out of a glitter cannon or something like that. But she wanted it to be a little more human, a little more fun. She wanted folks to be more aware of what is the process, what's going on. And if we're more aware of the process, we'll probably get past our grief a lot easier and form stronger relationships with our family members who might be approaching death. We might be able to take this unpleasant topic and talk about it at last.
Yeah, great recommendation. Yes. Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by Caitlin Doughty, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Steve Paul, we're going through the best books of 2014. If you have a pick and you want to tweet it to us, please do. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. And Steve, you want to talk about a book that got a lot of critical notoriety in 2014, 13 Days in September.
Yeah, this is just a great book of nonfiction by a very accomplished reporter, Lawrence Wright, who writes for The New Yorker. This particular book, the subtitle will tell you a little bit more of its general subject, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. Lawrence Wright is just exceptional, and he's covered the Middle East, American religion, and other difficult topics for many, many years. In this book, he takes a deep and really closely detailed account of a meeting in 1978 that President Jimmy Carter put together by wrangling Egypt's President Anwar Sadat and Israel's Menachem Begin.
And wrangling is putting it lightly.
Wrangling,
right?
He got them to come to Camp David, the presidential retreat in Maryland, and to sit down and talk to each other and not talk to each other and arm wrestle over this two-week period. It was just rather phenomenal. It's a chess game kind of writ large. And Wright seemed to have an incredible understanding of almost every moment of every day, every handle on every move that was made by both sides, or all three sides, rather, between Arabs and Jews. The thought behind every move.
Right.
The why, and he's got a real great wide angle of history and context on this this ancient struggle between Arabs and Jews, between Muslims and Jews. It's really a page-turning
I was going to say, is it a heavy read or a lighter?
It's not a heavy read at all. I mean, he's such a good writer, and it's a fast-moving narrative, and it's a page-turner because, one, he knows how to create a narrative, but two, is this portrait of diplomacy is so intricate. And you, and the thing that, that draws you in to a certain extent is he really makes these people human, and it gives you their back. You know, he gives you their backstory. You see these people not just as players in a momentary drama, but as real people. You know, and how personal history, their personal history, contributes to making, you know, history in the much larger, wider sense. You get to know them and understand them. And by doing that, you get to understand all the emotional and the political calculus that goes into this kind of negotiation, and that really continues to apply to all the treacherous things going on in the Middle East now. It applies to our policies, it applies to diplomacy, and just the mind-boggling web of relations that have issued down on us since that period in 1978. It's really a fascinating book, and really gives a good primer on the Middle East, which is kind of incomprehensible at the moment.
Yes.
And will continue to be so for a very long time. But again, it's just a great piece of nonfiction. 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David by Lawrence Wright.
Yeah, great pick. Okay, interesting. I've heard so many great things about that book. I'm interested in it myself. Angela, let's go to Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson.
Yes, Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson. It is a beautiful memoir told in free verse by Mid Woodson about her childhood growing up in South Carolina, and then the move her family makes to New York City during the civil rights era of the 60s and 70s. It's, you know, I'm not the only one who loved it in 2014. It also picked up a little award called the NBA, the National Book Award. I understand that Barack Obama picked it up recently during a Support Your Local Independent Bookstore Day in December, picked up a copy of it. This woman, this writer, Jacqueline Woodson, is just so, the way she can tell a story is just so well crafted. She seems to rack up awards every time she puts anything out. I'm just so jealous of her writing skills. I want to be her. She's amazing. And I have a little passage from her book. Let's see if I can find it real quick. That's just so beautiful to kind of show you a little bit more about how lovely she writes. And what's really nice about this is not only it to talk about her childhood, but it also talks about how she found her voice as a writer, how this young girl grows up to be the award-winning writer that we know now, Jacqueline Woodson. So here's a little passage from it. And somehow, one day, it just there, speckled, black and white, the paper inside smelling like something I could fall right into, live there, inside those clean white pages. I don't know how my first composition notebook ended up in my hands, long before I could really write. Someone must have known that this was all I needed. Hard not to smile as I held it, felt the breeze as I fanned the pages. My sister thought my standing there smiling was crazy, didn't understand how the smell and feel and sight of bright white paper could bring me so much joy. And this is just really lovely writing throughout the entire book.
This is
the first book I've read by Miss Woodson, and I'm looking forward to reading much more from her. She's just brilliant.
That book again, Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson. Okay, great pick. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're running through with our book doctors some of the best books of 2014. Jeff, let's come back to you and The Secret History of Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Which
I
could be you,
be,
right?
No, not quite.
Yeah,
Steve.
Your secret story.
Like to think so, but not quite. No, not this secret story. Believe me, not this one. So first I did a graphic memoir, and now I'm doing a comic book superhero. But anyway, The Secret History of Wonder Woman is by Jill Lepore, who is just the tireless historian who last year had a book of ages, that one of the top 10 books of the year for the New York Times, the story of Ben Franklin's younger sister, Jane Franklin, which I talked about on this show. And then this year she tells another hidden story, and that is the story of William Marston, who is the creator of Wonder Woman. William Marston wore many hats. He was an early psychologist when psychology was just in its infancy. He was a movie script consultant, an early movie script writer, and he also invented the lie detector test. Ironically, for someone who would seem to champion truth, he had a lot of secrets and a very unconventional household.
He had an itinerant academic career, and in one of his teaching positions at Tufts, he began an affair with one of his students, Olive Byrne, who was the niece of Margaret Sanger, the birth control crusader. And so he told his wife, Elizabeth Holloway, either Olive moves in or I move out. So their unconventional household was born. And they came up with their own answer to the age-old question, can a woman have it all? In their case, Elizabeth Holloway was the breadwinner, and Olive Byrne raised the children, four children, two by each woman. Now, Olive Byrne also had a part-time job. She was a freelancer for Family Circle magazine, and she oftentimes interviewed William Marston as her expert psychologist without revealing that she lived with him. And one of the articles, she asked him his opinion of comic books, which were just born in the 1930s and were highly controversial, and he endorsed them. This netted him a job as a consultant for a comic book firm, and then he proposed this feminist, progressive era superhero Wonder Woman. Huh. And, you know, he was coming of age at a time of suffragism and the suffragist struggle. He imbibed Margaret Sanger's book, I think, can't remember the title of it. Anyway, he believed in Wonder Woman, and he was a person of a lot of contradiction, obviously. So Wonder Woman was born, appeared in comic book covers in 1941. She has never been out of print. She always appeared in this little skimpy costume, which courted a lot of controversy. And she oftentimes was bound in chains, and she broke out of those chains. But Jill Lepore suggests a kinkier aspect of the chain thing rather than just a metaphor for woman's bondage. And anyway, it's a fascinating book and a fascinating story. But
she's pretty prolific turning out two books like this as quickly as she did. I mean, my goodness.
It's very readable, snappy scholarship. And the main scholarly point that Jill Lepore makes is that feminism is usually thought of as arriving in two big waves, the suffragist movement and the women's movement of the 60s and 70s. And she maintains there was a lot of feminist agitation going on in the 40s in the pages of Wonder Woman. So I would very much recommend it.
Okay. That sounds great. That book, again, The Secret History of Wonder Woman. All right. Katie, I was going to ask you first before you go into your next book here, as many of our listeners probably have already been hearing about, Morning Edition is going to be announced its book club last month. The first selection is Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. I got it for Christmas. There'll be an on-air discussion with the author on Morning Edition on January 20th, and it's a heck of a book, I hear.
It is.
A lot of folks saying it's the best book of the year.
It is. Yeah. It's definitely made the list, multiple lists for best books of the year. I have not picked that one up yet, but I have had a number of my book groups ask me for that, and I was really pleased that that's the book that Ann Patchett selected.
I saw that.
And that's a wonderful first choice for this, and I'm actually going to be chatting with one of your colleagues about it later on today, about how does the library and KCUR work together on the Morning Edition Book Club.
Yeah, sounds great.
So this is definitely worth a read, this book.
Excellent. That happens on January 20th, the first installment there. Well, tell us about your next pick, Katie, The Weight of Blood by Laura McHugh.
Oh, yes. She's a regional writer, and I think of her as sharing literary space with Daniel Woodrell.
Nice space to be in.
Yes, very much so. She sets her debut novel, it's a crime novel, in the Ozarks, and it's told in two threads. It opens up first with Lucy, a teenager, who's disturbed by the recent murder of a classmate, Sherry. And that murder, Lucy comes to find out, might tie in to her own mother's disappearance, Lila, who disappeared when Lucy was a baby. So the book flashes back 20 years, and readers learn why this young woman, Lila, who's witchily beautiful and disturbs the town with her looks and her outsider ways, why did she come to One Horse Hentmaine, Missouri? And then the events leading up to Lila's becoming one of Missouri's own gone girls. It's got great pacing, a wonderful sense of place. It really does belong in that Ozark noir canon that Daniel Woodrell is known for. One would think that McHugh and Woodrell and even Gillian Flynn are this exclusive little writers club determined to keep tourists out of the Ozarks, because I don't know anyone wants to go and visit the Ozarks that they write about. So, but The Weight of Blood has wonderful pacing, and it's very suspenseful. And both threads do pull together at the very end, even though the majority of the story is told from the women's points of view, Lucy and her mother, Lila. In the end, there are a couple of other characters that tell their stories and help flesh out the two mysteries and a couple of other mysteries as well. But the weight of blood that Laura McHugh refers to is where do your ties and your loyalty to family fall when it's crimes against family that have been committed.
Huh. The Weight of Blood by Laura McHugh. All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with our book doctors here. Lots other great books from 2014. We'll get to all of them. We'll get to your recommendations, too. Just tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can always find anything you miss here at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we look at how Diane Sawyer, Katie Couric, and Christiane Amanpour broke into the Boys Club of TV News. And we'll find out why former Kansas Congressman Jim Slattery wants to establish diplomatic relations with Iran. That's tomorrow on our show. This hour, we're talking with our book doctors today, Jeff Ann Gowdy, Steve Paul, Katie Stover, Angela Cervantes, and Steve Paul. You are up next. We're talking about the best books of 2014. Steve, you wanted to pick another nonfiction book. This one, Hotel Florida by Amanda Vail.
Amanda Vail. Yeah, Hotel Florida, or more probably Hotel Florida, which was a location in Madrid during the Spanish Civil War. It's the place where journalists who were covering the Civil War hung out and based their coverage of that great pre-World War II conflict. This book is really fascinating for in a number of ways, subtitled Truth, Love, and Death in the Spanish Civil War. Amanda Vail paints kind of a triple portrait of three couples or a sextuplet of people whose lives kind of collide and run in parallel during the Spanish Civil War. It's a really interesting way to tell the story of that conflict. Among those people, a couple you no doubt have heard of, one being Ernest Hemingway, and two, his budding, shall we say, girlfriend at the time, Martha Gellhorn, who was also a journalist in her own right. And their fling was just at the beginning as his marriage was breaking up in 1936-37. So that was one couple. They're the Americans over in Spain covering this war. In addition, another couple, Robert Capa, who is a photographer whose images from the war have become incredibly famous, and his girlfriend, Gerda Taro, who was also a photographer, and they often took pictures together and kind of shared bylines for them. They were fearless. They were really interesting people. Spoil your reading of it, because I don't think it would. I mean, we know the fate of some of these people, but I found the death of Gerda Taro in the midst of that conflict to be a really kick in the stomach. I mean, when it came along, it was really an interesting moment as she was leaving the front of one particular battle and ended up dying as she and others were driving back to Madrid. The other couple, Arturo Barea and Ilsa Kuchar, he was the foreign press officer, so he got to know these people. This is where some of that, those connections come in. And Ilsa was Austrian, and some people thought she may or may not have been a spy. And they had to, as the war was proceeding, and as Franco's forces leaning towards victory, they had to flee Spain, and the story of that and the aftermath of the war and their arrival elsewhere really is fascinating. Kind of ties everything up. But Hemingway comes off not as a great hero, and in fact, you might come away not liking him or liking him even less after you read this book. Gellhorn is a complex character in her own right, and just the way. we understand this war, again, as a precursor of World War II, comes off in somewhat of a new way. And I recommend it highly. It didn't get a lot of attention in the last year, although I think it's made some top 100 lists, including the stars. But beyond that, I thought it was a pretty good read. It's a big book, but it moves quite along because she jumps, from one setting mm-hmm. to another and kind of weaves these tales concurrently. So makes it move along. Again, it's Hotel Florida: Truth, Love, and Death in the Spanish Civil War by Amanda Vail.
Okay. Catherine tweeted us her favorite read of 2014, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony mm-hmm. Doerr is my pick for favorite book of 2014. Heard a lot of good things about that mm-hmm. book, too. Angela Cervantes, let's move on to you here. And We Were Liars.
We Were Liars. Yes, by E. Lockhart.
Dare say that to us. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a great book. It was unexpected. I was spending Thanksgiving in North Carolina, and I was bored out of my mind, and I needed an escape, and this book came across. And I finished it in one day. Take that, Jeff.
I did about a half a day for me.
And it didn't have any pictures.
It didn't have any pictures.
I haven't finished it yet.
Yeah, but it's such a page-turner. It's a lovely book by E. Lockhart. It says it's for young adult, but it's really for any audience. It's so well-written, and it's very clever. It's a story told by our narrator, Candace, who's a teenager. And it follows her rich, beautiful cousins, her family's trips to a private island off of Martha's Vineyard, I want to mm-hmm. say. Mm-hmm. They have their own private island. They are waspy. They're beautiful. Just the beginning of the chapter starts, "Welcome to the beautiful Sinclair family. No one is a criminal. No one is an addict. No one is a failure. The Sinclairs are athletic, tall, and handsome. We are old money Democrats. Our smiles are wide, our chins square, and our tennis serves aggressive." So you get the sense right away of this family and this world we're coming into. And it's a new world for me. I've never read such a novel. And the whole novel, you're kind of trying to figure out, our narrator has been in an accident, some sort of horrible accident. We don't know what it is because this accident has left her with bouts of amnesia, crippling migraines, dependent on painkillers. Mm. And so we're learning about the truth of what happened in this accident as the narrator is too. And it just kind of really unravels very slowly, but at a very good pace that keeps you wanting to turn those pages. And I did not want to stop. I didn't care if Cornish hens were burning in the stove. I was like, I'm going to finish this novel. It's just so enthralling. And when you finally find out what happened on this island, it's satisfying. It's painful. It left me in a fetal position sobbing for my mom.
Wow.
It's just so good. And it's got lots of good reviews, but it also has a lot of some reviews, people feeling like they figured out the twist before it came, that sort of thing. And some people do. But it's I really highly recommend it. It was a great read. You can finish it in a day if you have the time.
That book, again, We Were Liars.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Let's move on here. Jeff Van Gowdy, 1004 by Ben Lerner.
Yeah, 1004 by Ben Lerner. 1004 was the time that was on the clock tower when it was struck by lightning in the movie Back to the Future. And if you took a time capsule and put a lot of 1980s references and memorabilia into it, like the Challenger explosion and like Back to the Future, you'd get a little flavor of Ben Lerner's second novel, 1004. I didn't nominate this book for the Stars 100 list because I had a conflict of interest. I've known the author since he was 7. He's a Topeka native. This is an absolutely brilliant book, though. It did make it onto the Stars top 100, and it made it onto a lot of top 10 lists, including that of Dwight Garner's of the New York Times. What I love about Ben's fiction is it's like inhabiting the mind of somebody who's brainy, sensitive, nuanced, funny, and knows how to chart all the little backways and byways of consciousness in a very sensitive way. Readers should be forewarned that in the early pages, you should have a dictionary at your elbow because you will be looking up a lot of words. Or in the case of me, I make lists and then go back, hopefully, and check it out. Anyway,
This is Ben's second book. Leaving the Atosha Station was his first book, which was also a brilliant success, and it was a coming-of-age novel. And in this book, the narrator has come of age and moved into a larger world, and it's a world that's threatened by climate change. The book opens and closes with Hurricanes Irene and Sandy, but this book makes a vote for a future, uncertain, dangerous future. The narrator tutors a young boy, and the narrator contributes some sperm to his a best friend who wants to get pregnant, who doesn't have a partner. And so he makes this vote for the future. Much has been made about Ben's fiction blending fact and fiction, which has been done for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I was having an email exchange with a book editor who said, heck, you know, most first novels are autobiography, but maybe not to the extent that Ben does it. But what is singular about Ben's book is the artistry with which he blends fact and fiction. I was also thinking about Renata Adler, Pitch Dark, and Speedboat, 1970s novels that were collage-y, that blended fact and fiction. And in fact, a lot of critics referred to it as faction. And it's sort of in that mode, and he's experimenting with the form. One thing the narrator says is, who writes poems, as Ben writes poems.
Yeah, the narrator named Ben, who happens to be a writer.
Yeah. Anyway, that one thing he loves about poetry is that the distinction between fact and fiction, biography and fiction, does not obtain. I mean, when someone reads a poem, they don't think, did this happen to the writer or not? I mean, right. Those aren't the questions that you bring to the table. So I would highly recommend it. I think it's a really brilliant book. It's getting lots of good press, and it was published in Britain last week, and it's getting great reviews in the British newspapers. Oh. So Topeka native, Ben Lerner, 10:04.
I just read the review from the Telegraph in London, and which said, 2015 has just arrived, but I'm pretty sure this will be the best novel I'll read all year.
Wow. Wow. 10:04 by Ben Lerner. Thank you for that recommendation, mm-hmm. Jeff. Kelly tweeted, would love to hear the panel's thoughts on Dear Committee Members and the Paying Guests, which I gather is a book. Yeah.
Well, it's actually two. I read Dear Committee Members by Julia Schumacher. I have a copy of Paying Guests, and I haven't read that one yet. Dear Committee Members is an epistolary novel, and it's got a very sardonic, witty, pissed-off sense of humor. It's all these letters written by a curmudgeonly professor at some obscure liberal arts university in the Midwest, and he can't quite manage the online recommendation form, so all of his letters of recommendation are printed out. And as you read this very speedy book, you get his very bited commentary on the state of academia, and we come to learn why he's divorced and why his girlfriend has left him. He doesn't really have the most positive personality. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not somebody you'd want to stay the rest of your life with. But it's funny. It's sad. He's trying very hard to help one of his students get a place in a writer's colony, and you come to find out that the student's a little bit disturbed, and some other things are going on in this writer's colony, and we learn how those previous actions have impacted this particular professor's writing career. He was one of those one-book wonders in the 80s, and he's trying very hard to get his second novel off the ground. But it's funny. It's a little tragic. It ends in a satisfactory manner, and you do come to admire the writer, the professor at the very end, that he's sticking to his academic guns. He's got morals and values that are probably a little loftier than most of the folks surrounding him, and he displays them in a not-so-admirable way.
Well, that book, again, Dear Committee Members, and a separate book, The Paying Guest, which Katie hadn't read yet. So, okay, well, get on that one, would you please, Katie? Yeah.
I can't read in a day like Jeff and Angela.
Yes. Well, Station 11 is your next pick here, Katie, by Emily St. John Mandel.
Right. This was a finalist for the National Book Award, too. And I think this is one of the best pieces of fiction I read last year. It's a book club read. It's a literary novel that moves very, very quickly. And I, one of the reasons why I picked it up is it's post-apocalyptic fiction. I sort of have a sick bent for that these days. And what I liked about it is it wasn't all dreary post-apocalyptic fiction like The Road. More, it was a little more fun, a little more theatrical, because it is about this traveling troupe of musicians and actors after the world has ended. Now, it starts, though, with the kind of opening that Stephen King would just kill to write. He would envy how Mandel describes the death throes of humanity. An almost washed-up actor suffers a heart attack in the middle of a performance of King Lear on the same night that a plague begins wafting around the world, snuffing out life in a matter of days, and this plague is unleashed once all of these airplane passengers deplane in Toronto. Fast forward about 15 years to see how some of the survivors in the first segment of the book are doing, and you learn that one of the young child performers in King Lear is now an adult. She barely has a memory of the before world, and she's one of this band of traveling musicians and actors, and they just bring performances of Shakespeare plays and music, whatever they can remember, to these little settlements around the United States. There's no electricity, there's no internet, but they are going to keep arts and culture alive, much the way we did in Shakespeare's age. Running theme in the book that I really liked is, because survival is insufficient, I guess it's a quote from Star Trek, and it's tattooed on one of the actors, that there is more to life than just surviving. And that's, I think, the running theme in Emily St. John Mandel's book. I know a lot of book groups are going to be picking this up and asking me for it. It just reads so quickly. It reads like water.
Wow. Okay. That's Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. All right. Steve, Paul from The Star is still holding down the nonfiction leg of this program, and he wants to talk about another nonfiction account here, The Sixth Extinction.
Okay, I thought I was going to fast forward to fiction, but to join my friends around the table. But I'll stick with nonfiction, and it's rather telling, I suppose, that three of the books we've talked about so far were written by writers for The New Yorker,
yes,
who just happened to be pretty good, and end up with books out of much distinction. This one is by Elizabeth Colbert, who's very well regarded as a writer about the environment of the sixth extinction. Don't say that five times fast, but is an unnatural history. And what she does is she travels the world to tell us the story and to kind of ask the question whether we're in the midst of another cataclysmic loss of biodiversity. So she visits the Arctic. She visits from the tropics to the Arctic with scientists who are looking at the deaths of various species, snakes, frogs, insects, and to try to determine whether climate change, as she has written about much, is really changing the biological makeup of the Earth again, and what that might mean, what the consequences for that might mean. Loss in biodiversity means is much. Can mean a lot of things, but it's essentially a degradation of the natural world. I don't think she's quite as good a writer as Lawrence Wright is, but she really does take you to these places with some style and with a real curiosity. It's cut up very nicely in segments. It's fast going, and it's not all that optimistic about our long-term future, but it does put this particular segment of climate change in kind of geohistorical context, and I found it pretty good read.
The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert.
That is correct.
It's interesting. Almost all of you, as you talk about your books today, are talking about the pace of these books as being fairly rapid. You know, Katie, I gather that in this day and age with Twitter and Facebook and everything else, that a slow-moving book ain't going to cut it anymore. Am I right about that?
Well, that's not an adjective I'll use to describe a slow-moving book. My preferred adjective is leisurely paced. Yeah. There are still people that want a book that takes a lot more, that takes more of time to tell the story. Do we want speedier paced stories? Sure. Those have always been big sellers, and Dan Brown is the one that made us all admit that, yeah, we want a cotton candy story that we can digest very easily.
I'm not on that boat.
Steve, on the other hand.
What I was actually going to say on this very point, I was prepared to talk about one and maybe sneak in a second book of short stories and talk about that very thing. And that a couple of these, you know, I didn't read a lot of fiction last year. One longer novel, but a couple of short story collections, which I thought were really fine, and for that very reason, I mean, you can consume them in gulps. They speak to our fast paced ADHD, existence, and they're entertaining and they're very good. I mean, short stories are crafted to be gems and good ones.
But we don't have to worry about speedy pace taking over everything. I mean, I brought Bone Clocks. It's taken me the whole year to read that.
I mean, so some of these books I've talked about, I mean, they took me 2 or 3 weeks to read over time just because that's my life. But I kind of raced through these books of short fiction, Laurie Moore's book and the other National Book Award winner, Phil Clay's Redeployment.
I want to read that military one.
It's quite good. And I was going to recommend them just for that very reason.
Angela, let's come back to you here, and you want to talk about a book from one of our Supreme Court justices.
Yes, and I apologize. This is not from 2014. I just read it in 2014.
Well, that sort of qualifies.
Well, I think so. It's one of my faves. It's Sonia Sotomayor. It's her book, My Beloved World. It's nonfiction. It's her autobiography. It goes all the way up until she becomes appointed federal judge in the state of New York. It's all about her childhood, growing up in New York, trips to Puerto Rico, going to Princeton, and then later Yale Law School. And it's amazing. And this is one of those books where, like Steve said, it took me 2-3 weeks to get through. Not because it's not excellent. It was such a treat that I gave. It was like cookies and milk before bed. I would let myself read a little chapter right before bedtime because it's so full of wisdom. And she's such a good writer and so inspiring and smart. It taught me more about Puerto Rican politics than I want to know and federal law than I want to know and the ins and outs of Princeton and Yale. But it was fascinating, and I just loved it, and I highly recommend it. So, yes, it's one of my fave books this year that I read.
My Beloved World.
Beloved World.
Yeah, sounds great.
They're eating that up this year.
Are they?
Yes, I can't keep enough copies on the shelf.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. I had a request for that this morning before I came in.
Yeah, and it's just one of those books where I've told everyone, after I'm done with it, I'm going to pass it on to you. I just want to share it with everyone. It's so good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jeff, Boy, Snow, Bird.
Can I talk about Throne instead?
You can talk about Throne instead. Carrie Howley.
Okay. Well,
I just take them in the order you give them to me.
I should say, too, that Ben Lerner is the son of Lawrence residents Stephen Harriet Lerner, who has been a guest on your program.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Throne by Carrie Howley. This does sort of the reverse of what Ben's book does. Carrie Howley splices in a little fiction with her fact. Which I didn't catch right away, and it took me by surprise. But anyway, she was a graduate student at the Writers' Workshop in Iowa, and she creates a semi-fictionalized narrator named Kit, who is a graduate student in philosophy, to tell this true story of the 3 years she spent shadowing two mixed martial arts fighters. And as I said when I talked about this book on this show in September, I mean, MMA is not a subject that I would normally read about at all, wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. But this is a very engrossing story. This is a book that's full of contradictions. It's a beautifully written book, an elegant book about a brutish sport. It's sort of,
gut-wrenching, on the mat, you know, throw them around kind of sport. And yet it's very erudite. The narrator is a graduate student of philosophy, so there's lots of philosophical ponderings about violence. But she really captures the sort of bromancy, cultish world of MMA. She explores class differences, these cage fighters. One is a sometimes construction worker, sometimes bar bouncer from Davenport, who is also an MMA fighter. The other guy, these people are really living on the economic margins to pursue this. The other guy just lives in Cedar Rapids and works out at his brother's gym. But his big dream is to get on television, you know, an MMA. So it's actually a very fascinating book, and it made a lot of best books lists. It's Slate Magazine named it one of the top 10 books of the year. Lev Grossman of Time Magazine is number 2 nonfiction pick.
Well, how about really made a splash. When you said it mixes fiction and nonfiction, what's the fiction?
The fiction is the semi-fictionalized narrator.
Does it bother you?
I didn't even get it the first time, Steve. I wrote my review, and then I read some other reviews, and they said there was a semi-fictionalized narrator. I was like, what the heck? Yeah. So I had to quickly write the editor and say, stop the presses. I got to revise my review. Yes, it did bother me a little bit. I mean, I went to journalism school, for God's sake. You know,
right.
Our reputation hinges on accuracy. I think people are experimenting with forms, with narrative forms, and a lot of people who write creative nonfiction, you know, employ the devices of fiction to make their story interesting, like shape and dialogue and all this.
But to
invent,
thing, but
yeah, exactly. It took me by surprise, and I did have some discomfort with it. Yeah. And the editor who ran my review said she had a real hard time putting nonfiction on, you know, nonfiction review on the label.
Yeah.
But she did. So
all right.
It's gotten incredible press. Carrie Halley's Throne.
All right. Katie Stover, can you do one really quickly, like in 45 seconds? Five Came Back by Mark Harris.
Oh, very quickly. I love this book, and I listened to it because the heft of this book just freaked me out. But Mark Harris chronicles the wartime experiences of five of Hollywood's legendary directors, George Stevens, William Wyler, John Huston, John Ford, and Frank Capra. And they all enlisted for different reasons, and they all had experiences that they brought back that changed the way Americans look at movies in general and wartime films in particular. Wyler wanted to look for some of his Jewish relatives, and he wound up flying bombing missions over Germany. Huston made a documentary on post-traumatic stress disorder in World War II soldiers. The Army kept it hidden for over 30 years. It's so painful. Stevens is the man who recorded that horrific footage at the liberation of one of the concentration camps that we see regularly. This is not easy reading or listening, but it's eye-opening and it's compelling. And Andrew Garman, the narrator, does a fantastic job with the narration. His voice is, it's compelling. It's not no theatrics, just straight storytelling.
Okay, Five Came Back by Mark Harris, right? Okay, we are out of time. I want to thank our book doctors today for their time. Jeff Ann Gowdy, Steve Paul, Katie Stover, and Angela Cervantes. Thank you all very much, and Happy
Thanks
New Year.
Great.
It's going to cost me some money here, I think.
Yeah.